This is Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program that explores the music and the artists behind the 2018 season of the Aspen Music Festival and School and previews upcoming performances. I'm Chris Moore. This program comes to you from Aspen Public Radio, the official voice of the Aspen Music Festival and School, and can be heard online at aspenpublicradio.org. Funding for Festival Showcase is provided by the Barnard Fane Foundation. Today, Alan Fletcher and Asador Santurian from the Aspen Music Festival and School come in for their traditional opening interview to tell us about the entire Aspen Music Festival season. Well, Alan, Asador, I'm so glad you managed to make time to come here to Aspen Public Radio again and tell us about what's coming up with the season.
It's always a pleasure, Chris. Thank you.
Again, when I look at the festival, it has all the basic structure in it. It has the same orchestra playing. It has the opera features, the chamber music, et cetera, et cetera. But could one of you tell us a little bit about why you chose Paris, City of Light? And I have a few things I might want to say about that as well, but just how that theme is winding its way through the 300 concerts you have this season.
Sure, it was Asador's proposal, so let him start, and then I'll comment on why I agreed.
Paris, City of Light seemed to be a natural lead-in as we look at so many anniversaries this year, Debussy's anniversary and Friends of Nadia Boulanger, and to weave all these ideas together to a theme that could service solo literature, chamber music, vocal, operatic, as well as symphonic. It needs to be both broad and rather quickly identifiable. There's nothing interesting about Debussy anniversary if we don't do the Fall of House of Usher and Pelléas and Mélisande and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. But there is something very interesting about Debussy's music, and there's quite a number of works of his on the season, on a canvas in contrast or in juxtaposition with colleagues and or perhaps antonyms. Mm-hmm. Of Debussy. So the idea that he really is the father of contemporary music is part of this, but we decided to just focus on a very specific period in French history, 1860 to about 1930, mm-hmm. enveloping many of these ideas along with the flourishing of the Impressionism movement and then the Americans coming to Europe.
I notice also that you end the season with Wagner's Die Walküre, some excerpts from Wagner. And Wagner had a huge impact, both positive and negative, on the French composers. The first two composers I played yesterday, Chabrier and Debussy, both fell in love with Wagner and then reacted against Wagner and everything else like that. Was that done on purpose, too, to bring Wagner into this?
Yes, absolutely. And Wagner's reception in Paris, it was almost the greatest enthusiasm in all of Europe for Wagner was in Paris, and mm-hmm. he made special versions of some of his operas for the Parisian audience. Listening to Asador talk about the Paris theme, I want to step a little further away than from the individual composers or even an individual period. When Walter Benjamin called Paris the capital of the 19th century, he was thinking not only of politics and economics and the Industrial Revolution and what was happening that way, but of the extraordinary integration of the arts into the civic life of Paris. This is visual art, this is literature, and it's, of course, music as well. I just feel that in these times, we again need a reminder that artists are truth tellers, and mm-hmm. that the art of music, among all the great things about it, is also an extraordinarily honest art. The act of going on stage and performing is an act of greatest authenticity. And this is a time when we need to think about that.
I was wondering about that, too, in that the social milieu of Paris was one where all the artists are getting together. And I'd kill to go back to some of those coffee houses and some of the bohemian neighborhoods. Do you want to pick up a little bit more on what Alan said, Asador, about the cultural life of Paris and what it means to us today?
Well, it's a cultural historian's dream. We get a sense of it with Woody Allen's mm-hmm. Midnight in Paris. He concentrates on a very specific period, but he represents in the script, in the movie, various known members of that time in the club scenes. I would only add to Alan's excellent, I love that artists are truth tellers. I love that phrase. I would simply add that Paris was also a magnet for Chopin, Rossini, Liszt, Wagner. Many of these composers mm-hmm. are also represented on the season.
And then Defaya, Stravinsky, Prokofiev.
Exactly. And so there are several threads through the season. We have the composers that Alan just listed, who are discoveries of Diaghilev, who set up his Ballet Russe in Paris for at least 20 years. And then Boulanger invited the Americans. She was very willing to work with the Americans. And it was a real break with Americans going to Germany, and now they were going to go to France, and that was the start of that. And of course, it was not a melting pot. And that's the best part of looking at this window of time, that people didn't imitate Debussy. They learned from Debussy. They didn't imitate Ravel. They learned from Ravel. They didn't imitate Stravinsky. They learned from Stravinsky. And stylistically, they stood apart, and yet they define an era.
That actually reminds me of a conversation that George Gershwin had with Ravel once, because Gershwin wanted to take lessons. And Ravel came back to him and said, "Why would I do that? You are first-class Gershwin, and if you took lessons from me, you would be second-class Ravel."
Yeah, and another part of the same story is that Ravel said, "Can you tell me what your income was last year?" And whatever it was, Gershwin said, and Ravel said, "I think I'll take lessons from you."
Yeah, exactly. Well, one thing that I've noticed about the choice of programming that Karen and I are doing this year for Aspen Public Radio for my classical show is that I'm programming things that I realize I don't program as often. I tend to program more the Germanic composers or things that are maybe way out in left field type composers, etc. And I'm surprised to have to confess that these are really, really great composers who I don't ignore completely, but I don't give proportionally as much attention to as I do to other countries.
Well, we are not going to go all the way back to the Notre Dame school and the Ars Nova, but we are going back to some degree to the Baroque. And there were such different traditions in Italy and Germany and France and England in the Baroque era. I think here we've had very little French Baroque music over the past, say, 10 years. And now you'll be hearing that. And it's quite different what the French court composers were doing. Then in the classical period, both Mozart and Haydn spent important periods in Paris and wrote for Paris. We'll have those Paris symphonies happening. But then you get to the 19th century, where, as Zasador has said, that's where the core of our programming, especially late 19th century, is going to come. One just little thing I'm so happy about is Fauré piano music that we're going to have, which is so seldom heard in recital.
Exactly. The piano quartets, the piano quintets, and sonatas.
The solo works.
Yes, yeah, yeah, absolutely.
I know.
We're not focusing entirely on the French.
Sure.
There's still plenty of Beethoven 3rd, 5th, 7th symphonies are being done this summer. Brahms 2nd, Brahms 4th symphonies.
Mahler's 1st and 4th.
Mahler, yes, Das
and,
Lied
and
von
das
der
Erde.
Das Lied von der Erde with the magnificent Jamie Barton, and we're introducing a young Helden tenor this summer in that Das Lied von der Erde. I think it's his first outing on the piece and really first outing in a professional engagement, a concert engagement. And of course, Wagner was a major presence in Paris, as Alan described, and we end the season juxtaposing beginning of the 19th century with Berlioz and end of the 19th century with Wagner, scenes of France, Paris, France.
Well, you also have some series. You have a Beethoven series of piano music. You have a Bach series of the cello suites. Maybe you can tell us about any of those little, I wouldn't call them mini festivals, but other places where you're really giving some focus to these other composers.
Yeah, well, Jonathan Biss completes a three-year cycle of all the Beethoven piano sonatas, ending in our final week with two of the biggest, Hammerklavier and Opus 111. He will also be playing a Beethoven piano concerto on our opening Sunday, which is we're excited about. James Ennis, a very brilliant violinist, he's had a lot of success here, has not been here so often since he took over music directorship of Seattle Chamber Music Society, but he's agreed to do the complete Beethoven violin sonata cycle for us, and that'll be multiple summers as well.
That's right, and all of this is as we head towards the big 2020 anniversary Beethoven year. We'll have to wait to tell you what we plan for that year.
Right. Hopefully you haven't planned it all entirely by this time. We don't want to forget Elisa Weilerstein. I guess she's doing all the Bach cello suites.
Yeah, it's a tour de force to do them all. I think it's not only a fun thing, but it's musically a very meaningful thing to hear them all together.
Oh, yeah.
In that the six suites are very different from each other and also to some degree progressive as they go along. So it makes for a bit of a marathon, but we're going to have a long intermission and you can have a sandwich.
To me, it's astonishing that it was a flash of creative period for Bach, and they're sequential. No other works interrupt the BWV numbers, and that they are entire worlds individually, mm-hmm. and yet sequentially they present an evolution as well.
Maybe we can also just talk about, in a sense, the structure of the season for people who may not be familiar. Mm. Which orchestras you have, you know, the Saturday chamber concerts, etc. Would one of you like to try to take that on and give people just
Alan,
a basic sense?
Alan, why don't
sense?
You take the
I'll
lead
I'll
on
give
that.
A yeah. quick tour d'horizon of it. So we have four different orchestra programs every week. The Festival Orchestra is Sunday at 4. It's a very large orchestra. The Conducting Academy is Tuesday at 4 p.m. That is a free concert. Those are extremely interesting concerts. Very standard repertoire dominates those. The Aspen Philharmonic is Wednesdays at 6. That is an all-student orchestra, also a large orchestra. And then the Chamber Symphony, which has been one of the favorite hallmarks of the Aspen Festival for decades now, is on Friday nights at 6 p.m.
I might mention that the Chamber Symphony, sometimes I count something like 75 musicians in there.
Yeah.
It's not exactly, well, it's the largest you can get away with calling chamber imaginable.
Then opera. We have two fully staged operas in the Wheeler. Each runs for 3 shows. And then we have always an opera project that we do in Harris now. It's in honor of the Bernstein 100th Treble in Tahiti, which is going to be a gorgeous evening in midsummer. Chamber music, our faculty, we organize with some students and some distinguished guests on Mondays in the late afternoon and on Saturdays in the afternoon at 4:30. Mm-hmm. Then otherwise there are recitals populating the schedule, brilliant masterclasses that I think people should know better about, and the Opera Scenes program, which is Saturday mornings 10 to 12, another beloved hallmark of our Aspen season.
Alan, there's always new stuff happening with the Aspen Music Festival. You mentioned the standard things here with the orchestras, but do you have anything new up your sleeve this year?
You know, a really fun thing we're beginning is with the American Brass Quintet. Now, there's nothing new about them in Aspen. They've been with us more than 40 years. Mm-hmm. But we have created with them a new seminar strictly for brass chamber music, modeled on the seminar we've had since it was created by the Juilliard Quartet ages ago, the String Quartet Studies Program. Several quintets of young brass players will come, and they will do only chamber music. There will be thus enhanced opportunities to hear brass chamber music this summer, and as always, the American Brass Quintet will give a recital. We're excited about that. And then we've invited a professional choir, Seraphic Fire, they're based in Miami, to come join us and to create a professional choral institute, mm-hmm. which will be towards the end of the summer. Notably, Seraphic Fire will be joining the Chamber Symphony on August 17th for Mozart's Requiem, which I believe we have never presented.
Not in the last 3 decades.
No. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be a very special evening. Then going into the week after the festival has closed, Seraphic Fire will present a recital of choral music. That is on Monday, August 20th in Harris Hall, and then Fauré's gorgeous Requiem with also other choral music, but that'll be August 22nd in Harris Hall.
So I've known the Harrises for a long time, and Joan Harris is still a very, very much a regular. You know, she comes here from Chicago every year, and this is a very big anniversary, I would say, for her, because the 25th anniversary of the Harris Hall is happening.
Yeah, for myself, I can't even imagine what the festival was like before we had the capability of presenting chamber mm-hmm. music the way we can with Harris Hall, which just remains 25 years in, a miracle of a chamber music hall. I can tell you every string quartet that comes mm-hmm. says it's one of their favorite halls in the entire world to mm-hmm. play in. We have a special concert that Bobby McDuffie is leading on July 28th, but really all season we'll be thinking about what a jewel Harris Hall is.
Mm-hmm. Well, at the beginning of our interview, we talked about how the Parisians had a real sense of bringing truth to music or bringing truth to the arts. And a lot of that, I think, is happening socially these days. The Me Too movement has really taken off and has had a huge impact in the world of sports, in the world of entertainment, the movies, even the classical music world. And I want to ask you, as administrators, because now this kind of behavior that was tolerated for so long with sexual harassment, how administratively is the Aspen Music Festival and school handling the possible issue of something like that coming up?
Well, we've always given a lot of care to the social well-being mm-hmm. of all of our students, and all students and all faculty and all staff receive training and mm-hmm. in awareness in this. And so it's not that it doesn't happen, because it happens everywhere, mm-hmm. but it's that we, I think, have long been sensitive to that. A larger issue has to do with participation of women in classical music. I'm old enough to remember when the number of women at principals in orchestras was far fewer than it is now, mm-hmm. and where there was what I would call a structural disadvantage to women, say, playing the trumpet, I think that is now largely passed, and in our student body, we really don't see an issue in that respect. But in composition and conducting, one has to say there is still ground to cover. Last year, we had, I think, 5 of 10 composers were women.
That's right.
The first time ever for us. And also a great number of our guest composers were women, which is crucial because both women and men students saw the profession represented that way. In conducting, we have further to go, but this summer is very positive in terms of the inclusion of women in the Conducting Academy.
Yes, absolutely.
And our Mozart Requiem will be Xiang Zhang, conductor of the New Jersey Symphony, who will be joining us.
Yes, and Jane Glover will be back this year conducting, and I would say 4 or 5 of our composers, visiting composers, are women of the 7 visiting composers. We have Katia Agosh, from whom we've commissioned a string quartet for the Jupiter String Quartet's 15th anniversary. I can't believe they were students here 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And the Eschers, who were their classmates, are also here this summer. They're also 15th anniversary. But we have Helen Grime coming from London, Gabriella Lena Frank, potentially Libby Larson, as well as Sebastian Fagerlund and our own composers, Stephen Hartke, Alan Fletcher, and Christopher Theophanidis will be teaching our students this summer.
I want to ask kind of along the same lines, I suppose, and that is, in terms of your choice of programming, it seems that there have been some things that are programmed here that are that can be controversial to the audience because they have a political quality. And I don't think you really shy away too much from that. I wanted to ask how you feel about the bringing in of works that have social commentary or political points of view as a part of the musical expression.
Other than in the season where our theme was social conscience, I wouldn't say we program works because they're making a political statement, but we do program great works when composers have themselves concentrated in that. Going back to the Wagner and Paris, I think almost no one today would experience Wagner as a revolutionary, but in the spirit of 1848, he very much was.
He was procuring bombs in 1848.
and so his music really had a very political element in that time, which I think is interesting. Prokofiev was completely enmeshed, I think would be the word, in politics, whether he liked it or not.
Well, he pretended he wasn't.
Well, and certainly Shostakovich.
Shostakovich, of course.
Yes, yeah. But I think as an intentional gesture, no. I would say as a musical statement, yes.
It's not something you shy away from, is the point.
No.
But it has to have a musical merit.
Of course, there needs
to be something about it that also teaches, not only informs. That is the basic, the ground base of our programming, is that everything has to teach because students are involved in our famous side-by-side approach to imparting this oral tradition of music. There are many, many reasons I think the programming propels us forward. I think just the fact that these works are going to be performed by a generation of artists who will be with us for quite some time, but sometimes for the first time here in Aspen, sometimes for the second time. It's quite revealing. And there are also, for the audience, there are many, many, many aha moments. And I think over the years, Alan and I and our guests have programmed music to allow our audiences to trust us. So when we introduce something new, we do get the turnout. We do get that communal support for something new, and they will inevitably react to me or to Alan as they're exiting the tent, or Harris, and say, "That was very special. Thank you for bringing that." Or, "That artist was very special." So I think that also helps fuel and propel us into making these connections, discoveries, recoveries. This summer we have a brand new work of Igor Stravinsky. Not many people have heard it. It was recovered from his papers in 2015. It was written for his teacher's funeral. It's called Chants Funèbres. We have played almost every work of Stravinsky in Aspen. We're very proud of that. But this work is getting its premiere.
My goodness.
So it's an aha moment to come.
Well, Asador, you were just saying how people come and give you feedback, and both of you know I do that with you all the time. I hear a new artist, and I come up to Alan and say, keep that one.
Yeah.
You know? So I want to thank both of you again for all of your time and for all of your inspiration and guidance through this upcoming season. We look forward to seeing you at the tent.
Great. Thanks, Chris, and thanks, Aspen Public Radio.
Thanks, Chris.
If you've just joined us, this is Festival Showcase, and we've been talking with Alan Fletcher and Asador Santurian about the Aspen Music Festival season, two of the directors and two of the people involved in the actual programming. We will finish out our show today with a discussion with Conrad Tau, the pianist who will be coming in this Friday to play the Schumann Piano Concerto. There is so much extra musical, romantic stuff that Schumann put into it. Can you say a little bit about that and how you, as a pianist, are planning to bring some of that extra musical element forth as well as the music itself?
Well, I mean, for me, the most definitive element, at least the very clear, audible extra musical element, is in the second movement. This beautiful descending fifth line, which, truth be told, it might be apocryphal, but this kind of reading of it as Clara, Clara, it's something that I absorbed at the very least early on in my relationship to the piece. It's something that people talked about a lot. And so it's just always informed my approach to the work. It's a declaration of love. It's full of longing and romance and joy. I think I used to, when I first started playing this piece, I used to struggle with feeling as though it was supposed to be this big virtuosic thing. And I'm not really sure why I have that impression anymore, because that no longer makes any sense. But when I first started learning the work as a kid, I think the first time I started playing it was maybe when I was, I don't even remember anymore, 13, 14 perhaps. I think I had this aural image of it actually wasn't rooted in any reality. And so reading the work as much more personal and much more intimate instead of necessarily particularly extroverted, it helped a lot, and it continues to help a lot.
Also, I know you mentioned Clara, and obviously in this music there is so much love for her, and of course the struggle that he went through just to be able to marry her. Do you hear any of his alter egos?
I have been known sometimes in my performances of this piece to put some of that in, but I'm not sure. I mean, the work is structurally not as fantastical or surface experimental as, say, something like David's Bundlertanz or Kreisleriana or Carnival. I think that maybe this is a simpler work. Maybe this is, I think in a way, this isn't as much a work about Schumann himself. I feel like this is a work that includes other people, and this is a work about other people, which I also find a more useful way into the work, because it is a piece in which I have to be with other people. It's not a solo piano work. It's not something where I'm just living with my own interpretation or my own reading. There's a lot of chamber music in this work, as there is in any concerto worth its salt. And it requires an attention to stuff outside of just like your interiority. I think now I lean more on the side of, I don't necessarily think of it as an internal struggle. If there is Florestan in Eusebius, it's just in the fact that I think that makes up Schumann's musical vocabulary, no matter what. But it doesn't strike me as clearly delineated as it is in some of the later work.
Right. And I'm wondering, too, this is a work that, well, not exactly early Romantic period, but certainly not late Romantic, so we're not deeply right into the Romantic era when this piece comes out. Today, it's very much part of the standard repertoire, but I think at the time, there were some challenges for the listeners when they first heard this. Do you feel that you're trying to, in a sense, bring back some of that challenge and that excitement and that newness for this piece for the audience of its time, and bring some of that excitement into our time?
I don't want to say I don't think about how audiences are receiving what I'm doing, because that's not completely true. I think when you're sitting with an interpretation, or when you're sitting with the music and thinking about what it says to you, when you're really spending time with the score, that's a very internal process, but then you have to consider how you're going to communicate something to the audience, how you're going to communicate your ideas. And yet at the same time, I don't know, I think I try to just embed that freshness, if you will, just into my process. So I don't think I'm ever, well, I don't know about in the past. I think in the past I've thought about things very differently, but I don't think I'm trying very hard to consciously trigger like an unfamiliar, or I'm not necessarily trying to defamiliarize the work explicitly. I don't think that's exactly a sustainable goal on its own, because I think that that's like, that kind of gets you stuck in a reactionary place, right? If you're always thinking in terms of, I want people to hear this in a brand new way. I try to embed that more meaningfully into like the early steps of my process with the score. So what that means is, how do you meaningfully make a work seem fresh? You just actually look at it as though it is. And you look at the score and you try hard, and this is of course a real impossibility because we don't live in vacuums, but you try to think, okay, what if I let go of the baggage that you just inherit? If you listen to any music at all, if you listen to any performers at all, you inherit some sort of knowledge of how other people play the work. But what happens when you let some of that go, and if you try to consciously let some of that go and you just return to the score? Because I can be a little bit of a purist sometimes about thinking that everything should come from the score. First of all, following the score is actually not something that everyone is encouraged very actively to do all the time. I think partially because a lot of the time it's very easy to subconsciously kind of become imitative of other interpretations you've heard. But also, if you're really looking at a score and thinking about how do you take each marking, that's actually, for me, that opens up more and more windows. There's like a porousness and there's room for more interpretation, actually. If you're really closely following the score, you're actually making more active interpretive choices.
One of the things I think, in my mind at least, you're famous for is, first of all, there are passages that you play with the absolute physical limit of your capacity, like maximum volume that I didn't even think you could do. And then at other times you play with such softness and tenderness. Are you going to be using these extremes of you know, quintuple piano and quintuple forte in this interpretation as well?
I'm sure it'll be there, because I think that's just kind of my vocabulary as a player, to have these wide ranges. And, you know, there is a little bit of a reactionary element there, I think, for me too, for better or worse, where I think I do feel like I hear so much polite, middling, like mezzo piano, mezzo forte sound. And I when I was growing up, I think I sort of had this idea that just was like a default piano sound. And again, like I think I said earlier, it's just like, I'm terrified of this idea of a default. You know, I would like every choice that I have to feel like there's real intention behind it. It's not just, you do it because that's what you do. To me, that's like just really unsatisfying. That's my reasoning for playing in that kind of huge dynamic range. There's also a part of it for me where it's like, I think I also understand that like I'm in my early 20s. So there is a certain thing of just, well, this is how it feels for me right now. But I'm not, you know, I'm not interested in permanence. I'm not chasing after that.
Conrad Tao, thank you very, very much for your time today. We look forward to seeing you in Aspen.
Oh, thank you, Chris.
We've been talking with pianist Conrad Tao about the Schumann Piano Concerto, which is coming up in a performance with the Aspen Chamber Symphony this Friday. This has been Festival Showcase, a weekly interview program that explores the music and the artists behind the 2018 season of the Aspen Music Festival and School and previews upcoming performances. This program comes to you from Aspen Public Radio, the official voice of the Aspen Music Festival and School, and can be heard online at aspenpublicradio.org. Please join me Tuesdays at 3:30 for more interviews. My name is Chris Moore. Thanks for listening.